Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 8th of August, 2014 here in Japan. It is still the 7th of August in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Stephen Starr, MT, who has a rather formidable biographical history that I cannot do justice to in just a brief introduction here, but suffice it to say, he graduated from the School of Health Professions at the University of Missouri-Columbia in 1985 and subsequently worked as a medical technologist over a period of 27 years at a number of hospitals. He is an associate member of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and has been published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. His writings appear on the websites of PSR, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, the Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology Center for Arms Control, Energy and Environmental Studies, Scientists for Global Responsibility, and the International Network of Scientists Against Proliferation. He is also an expert on the environmental consequences of nuclear war, and in 2011 he made an address to the UN General Assembly describing the dangers that nuclear weapons and nuclear war pose to all nations and peoples. And he has, again, a very intimidating and lengthy list of publications and presentations that I will link to in the show notes for this this conversation. His website is nucleardarkness.org, which will soon be nuclearfamine.org. Either URL works, and so please keep those in mind. Again, that will be linked in the show notes. Stephen Starr, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, James.
Well, again, as I say, I only do a sort of brief injustice to your biography by summarizing it in that short biographical sketch. But perhaps you can tell us in a little bit more detail how it is that you came to this issue of the environmental consequences of nuclear war and the effects of nuclear war on the environment. How did this become an issue that you felt so strongly about and have been motivated by?
Well, I've been interested in nuclear war ever since, I think it was the third grade when they had the Cuban Missile Crisis. It kind of we were doing the duck and cover drills back then. And I don't know why, but it just left an impression on me. I wrote about it over the years, but I think in the 1980s, when the first studies that came out, it was the early 80s, it was Carl Sagan and a group of NASA scientists that were literally rocket scientists came out with first real scientific studies on what the consequences of nuclear war would be to the environment. And the term they came up with that time was called nuclear winter. That actually was a pretty big deal back in the 1980s. It was on the cover of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It was, you know, a focal point of environmental groups. And it really had a significant impact even on the relations on the U.S. and the Soviet Union, because in the mid-1980s, we built these enormous arsenals up. There were 70,000 operational nuclear weapons about 1986. And so, but these scientists came out and said, well, you know, just almost a small fraction of these weapons, if they were detonated in conflict in the cities of and the industrial areas of the U.S. and then the Soviet Union, the scientists used the best computers at the time and the best computer models and found that what would happen was the nuclear firestorms would create these enormous fires, nuclear weapons like a piece of the sun, and a large strategic weapon will easily set 100 square miles on fire instantly. And the smoke from these fires, the scientists found that it will rise above cloud level very quickly. And so there would literally be millions of tons of smoke. Within a few days, it would rise above cloud level into the stratosphere. So once it's above cloud level, it can't be rained out. There's high winds in the stratosphere, so that actually distributes the smoke around the Earth in a relatively, like 2 weeks, if you can make it around. And then over a period of weeks and months, it sort of equilibrates. So you just wind up with a global stratospheric smoke layer. It's a dense layer. And the amount of smoke is dependent on how many weapons you use. But the scientists found that, just a small fraction of the U.S. and the Soviet arsenal would be enough to create that would block enough sunlight that would produce temperatures on Earth colder than they were at the height of the last ice age about 18,000 years ago. And what that does is it basically eliminates growing seasons for 10 years or longer, and then you have what's called nuclear famine, became an accepted medical term. But obviously, if you can't grow food for 10 years, most of the people are going to die. And so that's a kind of a horrible way to start out your show, but that's a central concept that was introduced in the 1980s. And these guys had a number of smear campaigns targeted against them. And the science was belittled, and they were called frauds, and the concept of it went away. It actually disappeared from even the environmentalists became convinced that maybe it was bad news. It wasn't really good science. So I was aware of all this, but I got interested in the late 80s and started corresponding, and I actually wrote to some of the scientists and asked them about this. So that's how I first got interested. To make a long story short, some of the scientists went back and redid the studies about 2006 and 7 with the new computer models and the current arsenals, more or less, that we have now, and found that they'd even underestimated the consequences of nuclear war from the first studies. So I've talked quite a bit. Does that give you a good idea why I'm interested in it?
Oh, it certainly does. I mean, the question sort of answers itself, but always good to give you a chance to provide your own answer. And certainly the idea that, as a youngster, you did experience that Cuban missile crisis scenario, obviously, where the world was on a knife edge of tension, that obviously plays a huge part in the development of a young psyche. And no surprise then that this would be a fascinating topic. But unfortunately, I mean, we like to think of the Cold War and those types of tensions as being behind us. But unfortunately, we, even today, facing similar tensions right now in Eastern Europe.
Oh, yeah.
With the Ukrainian crisis, which, of course, I mean, no one likes to think about it, but the next war between major powers will have that nuclear option, and it is something that we have to understand the potential effects of. So why don't we start doing that? Let's take a look at a recent article that you wrote that was posted to paulcraigroberts.org and also on countercurrents.org called The Lethality of Nuclear Weapons, where you talk about some of the effects of nuclear a nuclear battle, but also some of the effects that people might not necessarily think about with regards to nuclear winter or issues of that sort, including the disruption of the ozone layer and also the electromagnetic pulse effects of such a strike, which could disrupt all sorts of modern electronic devices, which is something that could be equally deadly and important in our increasingly wired age. Let's talk about this article and some of the information you cover there.
Sure. Well, Paul Craig Roberts is one of maybe the only person I saw that was really actively promoting the idea that the true suicidal nature of nuclear war. And so I wrote to him, and he was generous enough to let me write an article that he posted on his website. And, I'll say a few things about their article. First, I've been at the United Nations working a number of years. I worked as an expert witness for someone like Switzerland and New Zealand to talk about these things. So, and in the process, I was told many times that it was, nobody really wanted to hear about a U.S. and Russian nuclear war because it just wasn't possible. It's, people have gotten so conditioned to the idea that nuclear deterrence works and that there's absolutely no danger of a nuclear war anymore that they've forgotten that the nuclear arsenals exist. And yet, the U.S. and Russia have about 15,000 nuclear weapons between them, and they have about at least 1,800 warheads total, like 400 or 500 missiles on each side that they can launch in a matter of 2 to 15 minutes. And the presidents are constantly accompanied by military officers with briefcases. They call it the nuclear briefcase in the United States. And in Russia, they call it shaget. But these are basically, they're similar to like big laptop computers. They can flip them open, and it allows the president to issue what they call a permission order to launch the nuclear weapons. And that, that can be accommodated in about 2 to 3 minutes. So I've never accepted the idea that nuclear war, the U.S. and Russian nuclear war, was something that was unthinkable, because we go to great lengths to make sure that it's quite possible. You asked me more specifically about EMP and ozone. There are three main effects. I mentioned the catastrophic formation of the global smoke layer. Once the smoke gets up into the stratosphere, it does two things. It blocks the sunlight from reaching the Earth, and so doing, the smoke gets heated up, so it actually gets to be 150 to 200 degrees hotter in the stratosphere than it normally would. So the scientists found that those increased temperatures will massively destroy the protective ozone layer around the Earth, and this will happen as long as the smoke persists there, which is at least 10 years or longer. So when that happens, in the mid-latitudes, you'd have at least a 40% increase an ultraviolet B light striking the surface of the Earth. So the scientists that did this at the National Center for Atmospheric Research found that they had to create a whole new scale in order to map this out. You know, the UVB indices, you know, right now 11 is considered extreme. That's when you're, you know, really not supposed to go out and, unless you have a lot of hat and sunscreen on. Well, their new scale had to go up to 26. So it meant that even in a place like Norway, you could get a painful sunburn in about 7 minutes exposure with sunlight as opposed to 45 right now. And the same thing in the central U.S. So that's one aspect. But, you know, frankly, and that I'll say another thing about nuclear war. They found that this, they predicted this can happen with even a war between India and Pakistan with 100 atomic bombs detonated in their cities. It doesn't have to be U.S. and Russia. That was what the people at the U.N. were interested in. They didn't want to hear about the United States and Russia. They just, but since the India and Pakistan arsenals were out of their control, that they found that to be something. I got a lot of requests to discuss that. But you should think of that as a baseline, essentially. That's the way they did the study, where, you know, because 100 atomic bombs have less than 1% of the explosive power of the launch-ready nuclear weapons that the U.S. And Russia have. So, you know, if 100 atomic bombs can do this, then, you know, and they, if you can imagine, you know, any even a, that article that I wrote, Lethality of Nuclear Weapons, I quoted a passage from one of these peer-reviewed studies that said, even a successful first strike, successful means the U.S. or Russia, but let's just say the U.S. launches a first strike against all the Russian nuclear weapons and destroys them 100% or 99%, and its ballistic missile defense shoots down the rest. That actually will create enough environmental consequences in nuclear war. It'll put enough smoke in the stratosphere that it will cause all the people in the United States to starve to death eventually. It still makes the Earth uninhabitable. And so without elaborating a lot more, I want to say what really disturbs me is when I see the U.S. and Russia having nuclear war games as part of this Ukrainian scenario. I mean, they both have had large, they call them nuclear war exercises. They've launched ICBMs, they've, you know, flown the bombers. And so they're practicing for this. You know, and there's no recognition. There's no... they act like they can win a war or they can fight it. But in reality, the nuclear war is suicide for both nations. And so how do we get, that's my question. How do we get the leaders to acknowledge and discuss this? Because I think if they did, the people in general just wouldn't accept the idea that we would keep these things around the way we do. Paul Craig Roberts, I think he made a great suggestion. He suggested that Putin go to the UN and then discuss this. Say, look, this is what we're heading for in Ukraine. If we get into a nuclear war, this will be the result. And, you know, the destruction of human life, all human life. So, but I don't know. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to get that message across. Except by talking to you, it's a good start, I guess, right?
Well, it can't hurt, I guess, in that regard. And I mean, you paint a very vivid picture here that that a nuclear conflict of any kind is going to be lose-lose for humanity itself, which is such a basic point that it almost shouldn't need to be articulated. But I think it does, because, again, we've been lulled, right, I think, into a false sense of security in the idea that, oh, this just couldn't happen, and the idea of a nuclear war is just sci-fi fantasy at this point. Yeah. When, of course, I think,
well,
as you say...
I teach a class on nuclear weapons at the University of Missouri. And, you know, the students at the university level, they don't know anything about it. It's not taught in schools anymore. They don't know the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. You know, they don't know anything about it. So I think that's part of the problem. We have a general ignorance. In the 5 or 6 years where I traveled around and spoke about this extensively, very few people knew how many nuclear weapons the U.S. had. And, you know, in fact, I read an article about the Armed Services Committee. Somebody, I think it was Global Zero, was interviewing the people on there, and they said, how many weapons, nuclear weapons, do the United States have? And none of the people on the committee had any idea. and, I, you know, in that Lethality article, I mentioned in 2010, I was at the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty Review Conference at the U.N., and I had a pass, so I was in sort of a kind of a private briefing, but it was public in the sense that there were reporters and ambassadors and a lot of people there and people from NGOs that had gotten into the UN. And so they had the two chief negotiators of the START treaty that were there, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and the Russian. They both were taking questions. So I flopped down in a chair that I think they thought I was the ambassador from France, or I'm sure they wouldn't take my question. But I asked them, I said, well, are you all familiar with these recent studies that predict the detonation of even a small fraction of your arsenals will create these environmental conditions that will make agriculture impossible for up to a decade and kill most of the people on the planet? And neither one of them knew about them. I said, well, we're not familiar with any recent studies. And I had the same experience again just this year at the NPT Preparatory Committee. They have them every year, but at the UN and either in New York or Geneva. And just by chance, the U.S. sent its representative there to do a briefing. And I got a big mouth, you know, but I asked them the same question. You know, I asked them, are you familiar with these studies? Because they were saying, well, if we ever use nuclear weapons, we would take everything under consideration. I said, well, would you take this? They said, well, we don't know about that. They admitted they hadn't heard of the study. So, you know, that I find that frightening because do they even know what they have their finger on? Do they think they can win a nuclear war?
Right. Nuclear ignorance, I think the vast majority of the U.S. population would probably be surprised because they've been conditioned over the course of generations now to think that nuclear weapons, of course, would be a last resort and only as a retaliatory measure for a nuclear strike and something of that sort. But I think most people would be surprised to find it as official U.S. nuclear policy as affirmed in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review and reaffirmed in the 2013 Nuclear Employment Strategy document that the U.S. reserves the right of making a first strike, nuclear strike, although they hope that one day they may be able to move towards rejiggering that goal over time, but again, it is part of actual nuclear employment strategy of the U.S. government that they do reserve the right to first strike use of offensive nuclear warfare, which mm-hmm. is just mind-boggling.
Right. You know, I always figure if they've got nuclear weapons, they have plans to use them. They may not discuss exactly what those are. But there are some experts, Hans Christensen with the Federation of American Scientists is one of the people that really seems to be able to get information that's unbelievable. And he has found the targeting priorities. He's found the documents that show what the main targets would be in a nuclear war. They're the other side's nuclear weapons or conventional weapons. Their political and military leadership and their industrial targets, which would, of course, be in cities. And so the plans exist. The government officials will always deny that they're planning on using these things, but, you know, you should look at capabilities. And what the capabilities are is that we've got launch-ready nuclear weapons, you know, ballistic missiles pop with warheads that can be launched in just a couple minutes. And once you launch a missile like that, you're not going to recall it. You know, they don't build self-destruct mechanisms into those. And we, you know, throughout the Cold War, we studiously avoided any sort of confrontation with the Soviet Union because both sides, you know, we had all kinds of proxy wars and lots of terrible things happened, but they never wanted to get, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis where we almost got into a shooting war with the Soviets. But at that time, you know, we were just coming out. I mean, that was 1962, I think. And the technology now is, you know, it's so different. I mean, it's so fast, you know. And I worry that once the fog of war starts, if we start shooting at the Russians in Ukraine, then God only knows, you know, both sides use what they call counterforce theory. And the basis of that is it's essentially preemptive. It says, in the event of war, the primary mission of the military is to destroy the other side's nuclear weapons first, as all those other targets. But first of all, take out their nuclear capability. And the only way you can do that is with a preemptive strike. Now, in peacetime, well, I think everybody for many years now said, well, that's never going to happen. We're not going to have a bolt out of the blue attack. But if we get into a situation where I was listening to a Russian advisor to Putin, Sergei Glazyev, and he was going on about how the Ukrainian army is mobilizing its forces right now. They just had their third general mobilization, and it looks like they're going to, the Russians, and that Glazyev said that they expect to have 500,000 Ukrainian troops by the end of the year. I asked Stephen Cohen about it in an email, and he said he thought it seemed a little high, but But he said, well, it's a stated policy of the Kiev that they're going to retake Crimea. So now if you turn to the United States and look at the Russian Aggression Prevention Act that's making its way through Congress right now, well, that will make Ukraine a major non-NATO ally. It will send them a couple hundred million dollars worth of U.S. military equipment almost immediately. And it also outlines penalties against anyone recognizing Crimea as part of Russia. So this reinforces what Kiev's saying. And Kiev's saying, we're going to retake Crimea. Their new defense minister made a speech recently to their Rada, their parliament, and he said, we're going to have a victory march in Sevastopol, which is where the Russian naval base is. So this is what my fear is. And I know I'm kind of going a long way from where you started this off, but I wanted to be able to enunciate what I see right now are clear and present dangers that I hope people will take time to react to. You know, we really don't want to pass this Russian Aggression Prevention Act because it will not only bring back the Cold War, it'll put us in a direct path for a hot war with Russia.
Well, I do appreciate you taking that detour, because I think it is important, once again, to break the conditioning of so much of the public, which is that this is such a remote possibility, the idea of nuclear warfare, where, unfortunately, it is, I think, a real possibility on the table. And it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to happen, but it is something we should be aware of. And it's our duty and obligation to be aware of the effects of nuclear warfare if we are going to just be blindly, you know, taken down this path towards confrontation with another major nuclear power. But I think something that we have to confront head on is another idea that I think has been sowed amongst the public, or at least the public that's aware of and cares about these issues, which is that there is a distinction to be made between strategic and tactical nuclear weapons, that basically the arsenals still exist, but they're no longer developing these gigantic Tsar bombs, 58 megaton yield, huge mega bombs. They're developing certain very, very precise types of nuclear bunker busters, the B-61-11, for example, for precise and strategic use against Iran's underground nuclear facilities or what have you. And the idea has been sown that these are going to be of a very different nature than the gigantic nuclear weapons that most people associate with nuclear warfare. I think the point needs to be stressed that the ultimate effects of these so-called limited nuclear strikes are not going to be significantly different, but let's talk about some of the science behind that.
Sure. Well, if you want to talk about the B-61, that's a good weapon to talk about because it's a gravity bomb that is deployed. Also, there's about 180 of them that NATO members have in Europe. But they're working on a new version of that. There's different mods of it or models. But a number of them have their lower end yield is 0.3 kiloton. Now, I found my students don't know very much, don't know what kilotons are, but a kiloton is equal to 1,000 tons of dynamite. And when we talk about nuclear weapons, it's the equivalent of TNT or dynamite explosive. So a ton weighs 2,000 pounds. So 1,000 tons is equal to 2 million pounds of dynamite. So that's a lot of dynamite. You know, our largest conventional weapons right now are something like 20 or, I'm blanking out on that, but it's about 20 to 30 tons of TNT. That's pretty big. The MOAB, mother of all bombs.
20 to 30 megatons, that is.
Tons. These are conventional.
Oh, conventional bombs. I see.
Yeah, the largest. What I'm trying to compare is the largest conventional weapon to the smallest atomic or tactical weapon. So if you go from 20 to 40 tons of TNT up to 0.3 kiloton is equal to 300 tons of TNT. So you're sort of in the same, range of magnitude. And the danger there is that you're blurring the distinction between conventional and nuclear weapons. It makes these weapons a lot easier to use because you can say, well, it's only 0.3 kiloton. And then we get into our policy where it's maybe not such a big deal to use nuclear weapons. Whereas during the Cold War, like I mentioned, there's a fire break. You would never, there was always this fear of using a nuclear weapon with another nuclear well with Russia or the Soviet Union, because if they have nuclear weapons, they're going to respond. That's just a general assumption. Now, the variable yield weapons, the B-51, can go up. There are different mods that go over 300 kilotons. So in a sense, these are 21st century tactical weapons. They call them dial-a-yield. They can make them go
right.
very small or very big.
Just to put these numbers in perspective, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were between 10 and 20 kiloton yields, and the largest bomb ever exploded was the Tsar bomb, as I say, in 1961, 58 megatons. But again, 10 to 20
kiloton. Yeah, megatons, a million tons. So, you know, we're going, those are just, you know, think about the effects. The Tsar bomb, the 57, 58 megaton could have ignited about over 2,000 square miles on fire instantly. The standard strategic nuclear weapons that Russia has on their ICBMs now are more like in the 550 to 750 kiloton. Like not less, 1,000 kilotons is 1 megaton. So we're not quite up to 1 megaton, but you know, a 550 kiloton weapon will set about 100 square miles on fire instantly, as opposed to 3 square miles for the Hiroshima bomb. So I mean, you know, these are all huge. You get mind-numbing with the numbers, but you know, basically the strategic weapons are somewhere between 70 and 45 times larger than the atomic bombs were. And the atomic bombs are weapons that India, Pakistan, and North Korea, the emerging nuclear weapon states, begin with. You know, these fission weapons that are relatively simple design, but that won't last forever. I assure you, they're going to have thermonuclear weapons one of these days too, kind of blow ourselves up first. So I didn't mean to preempt that conversation, but is that where you wanted it?
Well,
is that enough information?
Yes, and let's refocus this back on the claim that is made that the so-called strategic nuclear precision strikes with these limited nuclear weapons would not have the same effects or environmental fallout, which I think, for example, in the specific case of targeting Iran's underground nuclear facilities, was given the lie by a 2005 report by the Union of Concerned Scientists, which calculated that the radioactive fallout from such an event, especially considering you're striking nuclear facilities in the first place, would lead to millions of deaths throughout the region. Let's talk about that, those ultimate effects of these so-called strategic strikes.
Right. Well, specifically, when you talk about nuclear bunker busters, you know, we detonated a lot of bombs during the testing period, and they found that even a bomb that's a tenth of a kiloton has to be down about 200 feet below ground. You have to drill a well shaft 200 feet deep and seal it up with concrete, in order that won't blow through the surface and release a huge amount of radioactivity. So these bunker busters are going to, at best, when they come in at 17,000 miles an hour and slam into the Earth's surface, they might go 20, 30, 40 feet into the ground. And if it's concrete that they're hitting, it won't be that much. But and then they explode. But they're, just by definition, they're going to, if that's a dirty bomb, it's going to be a surface burst, and it's going to have a huge amount of radioactive fallout. And that was a good example. The Union of Concerned Scientists even had an animated graphic that illustrated what would I think it's Natanz or Iran, where they have their center for nuclear stuff, and it would blow all the way over. It would blow hundreds and hundreds of miles and would kill a lot of people. And that's one bomb. You know, I don't honestly, when you were saying that, talk about the environmental effects, but I've never heard the government ever talk about environmental effects of nuclear war. That's one of our frustrations. You know, we can't get them to address any of this. And it's the scientists that have done these studies, and these are really good scientists. They're scientists at Rutgers, UCLA, University of Colorado, Boulder. They're all extremely frustrated because they've turned out some of the best studies you can do with the state-of-the-art computers and computer models showing just with very little, you know, when you do a peer-reviewed article, it's published for a year before it goes into the final phase, and every scientist in your area can criticize it. And they publish these articles, and nobody could find any problems with them. So this is good science, and they're predicting, you know, all these dire things that I mentioned before, that even a they call it self-assured destruction, a successful first strike is enough, will still cause everybody in the side that wins to starve to death. So, you know, what I don't understand is why our leaders will not acknowledge or discuss this. It's, you know, I've come a long way in my thinking, but I don't know if it's just sheer hubris and arrogance and ignorance, or if it's even something worse than that. You know, I don't know. I talk a lot. You mentioned EMP, and that's an important thing, electromagnetic pulse, that can be created by a detonation of nuclear weapon a couple hundred miles above ground level in outer space. And it generates this huge burst of X-rays that, when it strikes the upper levels of the atmosphere, it's translated into this enormous pulse of electricity and magnetic particles that goes down and strikes the ground and destroys anything with an integrated circuit for maybe 10 or 20,000 square miles. You know, you could have one weapon over, say, the East Coast of the United States that did that. And what I talked about in the article was my concern about nuclear power plants, because I also write about the dangers of nuclear waste and nuclear power, which I've gotten to be pretty concerned about, too. Most nuclear power plants in the United States have spent fuel pools that have enough long-lived radioactivity in them to make an area the size of another state uninhabitable for centuries. And all of these reactors would melt down, and that radioactivity would be released, a great portion of it, with an EMP from a nuclear weapon. You could shoot off one nuclear weapon over the East Coast and melt down 60 nuclear power plants. So that's another aspect of nuclear war that's not talked about. They don't talk much about what would happen even, say, if North Korea dropped conventional warheads on the nuclear power plants that are on the coast of Japan and South Korea. You know, we know what happened at Fukushima. We've seen a lot. We're worried about an earthquake there. But if you can imagine, you know, some missiles coming and blowing up those fuel pools, I think a good part of Japan would become uninhabitable. So I'm not a big fan of nuclear power, as you can tell from my comments, but that should be another part of the discussion about nuclear war. So if you roll all of these effects, you know, loss of growing seasons, destruction of the ozone and radioactivity, it's just about as grim as you can imagine. So why are we still playing with these things? Why do we allow our these vast expenditures of money to maintain and operate and modernize these arsenals when, you know, anybody that can read, that can understand any kind of science should know that this is a self-destruct mechanism for the human race.
Well, that's exactly right. And we will refer people to a video that both you and I appeared in on Global Journalist Radio back in July, where we both talked about Fukushima and the effects of what's going on there.
Yeah.
And you made the point there, which I think is, as you say, quite apt, that, I mean, not only do we expect when we build a nuclear power plant that we'll be able to control the conditions of that power plant for however many thousands of years in the future, but also, I mean, not even taking into account things like war, which obviously play a huge role in this.
Yeah.
So it is, I mean, it is madness of a certain type. And
there's,
I guess,
a lot of taboo subjects, you know, that you're not supposed to talk about that. And
yeah.
So that's one of the things you don't hear about in corporate media. You haven't heard anybody talking about this on CNN lately, have you?
Yeah, no.
And I think there's a reason for that. I mean, they don't want an informed public when it comes to these things. You know, in the 1980s, there were a million people in Washington, D.C. that were protesting about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. And we don't have that level of consciousness anymore. And I think a lot of it's because they don't teach it in schools. They don't talk about it in the media. You learn about it watching Terminator 2 or something like that. But, you know.
Yeah,
people,
no, exactly.
People just don't know.
And that was actually formative in my own childhood. I remember watching that scene from Terminator 2 and being impressed by that. But at any rate,
yeah.
Again, I mean, it is interesting how these different cultural influences come to play. But we've had a fairly sobering conversation, and I wonder if there are any positive points that we can take from this. At any rate, we are having this conversation, which, as you point out, is not ever going to take place in the mainstream media. We do have these outlets on the internet and other forums for actually discussing these issues, at least at this particular time. Is there anything positive to be made from that we can actually circumvent some of the forms of media control that have taken place around this discussion for decades now?
Well, I think as long as we have an internet where we can and have this type of conversation and things can go viral, we certainly have the potential to educate people very quickly. Maybe it needs to be done in a little more succinct fashion. You know, it wouldn't hurt if we could get somebody like Steven Spielberg or somebody interested in doing a movie to illustrate this, or something like that, that would, you know, get the message across instead of making it sort of in the realms of science fiction and just arcane knowledge. That, I mean, honestly, you know, life is difficult. You know that for most people now, the economy's been bad. People, the middle class has been decimated. A lot of people are working two or three jobs just to try to pay bills. So thinking about nuclear weapons is not exactly on the top of the list, you know, but I think we have to get to some realization that neither the Republicans or the Democrats, the federal government is not, it's an oligarchy. We don't have a Democratic Republic anymore. And we can't just write letters to the editors and expect to, you know, change things. People have to be willing to get educated and take some action on their own. I don't know. I don't have a clear path to this, but I do think that, at the very least, you know, people, if they can learn enough about this and pass on some of the information, we have to change. You know, we need to get people like in Missouri here. I'm writing an article on the Russian Aggression Prevention Act because one of our Missouri senators is a co-sponsor of it. Now, that's insane, you know, because it really is a direct path to war with Russia. And so that's a good place to start. All you have to know is nuclear war is going to, you know, threaten to destroy you and your family. And do we want to fight a war in some place in Eastern Europe that you probably can't find on a map? I doubt it, you know. So I think you can do a lot more than you think. And the key really is probably sharing information on the internet at this point, as far as we're concerned.
Well, it certainly is going to be the way that we circumvent the forms of media control, and you raise the idea of a movie or some way of implanting this in the public consciousness. But of course, they couldn't even remake Red Dawn with the Chinese army as the combatants, because of course China is the world's largest growing and fastest growing market for movies. So again, there's so many forces that stop any type of.
That's funny.
Yeah. Well, it's sad. It's true. These are the economics of the situation that mean we will never probably, in at least in this current paradigm, see any of this reflected in any of the major media, which is why we have to become the media rather than just rail against it.
Right.
And unfortunately, again, I think you're right that most Americans and most people in many parts of the world, let's not just blame it on Americans, but can't find Ukraine on a map, let alone actually, you know, articulate why it is that that we need to be policing that part of the world with, again, the prospect of nuclear winter, nuclear famine, nuclear darkness hanging over us. All right. Well, I think we'll leave the conversation there. There's many, many more points to discuss, but people can go, of course, to the website for the Physicians for Social Responsibility, of which you're the senior scientist, at psr.org. And they can also go to your website again, nucleardarkness.org or nuclearfamine.org. Both URLs are currently working to try to explore more parts of this, the pieces of this puzzle. Are there any other sites or resources you'd like to direct people to?
Well, let's see. I think Federation of American Scientists is a good site. You mentioned Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, PSR. There's also ICANN, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and that's a lot of that's out of Australia. There's a lot of really well-informed and energetic people that are quite a bit younger than I am that are involved in that. And I've been really impressed when I was in Geneva. There was quite a few people there. You know, there's a great interest in this subject. It is particularly dark here, but you know, all of the countries that don't have nuclear weapons are actually intensely interested in not having a nuclear war, and that's part of the reason I worked at the UN for a long time. I mean, and there's humanitarian conferences that are occurring right now. There's going to be one in Austria in September, I believe. And, you know, there's the nuclear weapon states have been boycotting these because if they go, they'll be brought face to face with the humanitarian consequences of nuclear war that include these scientific studies. So, you know, speaking truth to power is powerful, but you got to get in a position where you can do it. You have to be able to. But I do think that, you know, take a little bit of time to educate yourself and try to do something about, you know, call your congressman or your senator and say, do not vote for this Russian Aggression Prevention Act. And, you know, think of what's going on in Eastern Europe with NATO. really does threaten everybody in the United States and in the world. And if they continue along these lines, we could easily wind up in a world war. And I worry very much about that. So I think it's time to you know, do something, you know, get motivated.
Get active or get radioactive. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, we will leave the conversation there. Obviously, still many points to discuss. So we will continue to follow your work. Please send your articles in, and I'll try to keep my audience informed of them. Stephen Starr, thank you again for your time today.
Sure. Thanks, James.